Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on Community Radio. Here we are around the kitchen table again. KHOI Community Radio. This is the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We get around the kitchen table once a week here, beautiful downtown Ames. We talk about food. We talk about farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. And we get by with a little help from our friends.
Okay, so support comes from Wheatsfield Co-op, your full service natural foods grocery in Ames, community owned, community focused since 1974, open daily 7 a.m. to 9 p.m., located downtown at 413 Northwestern, just off Main Street in Ames. Everyone can shop Wheatsfield Co-op. And also, the Donalana Kitchen is supported by Farm to Folk, an Ames-based food cooperative supporting farmers and bringing local farm produce and meats to you throughout the fall and winter. Information on a la carte buying options available at farmtofolk.com.
What a lovely fall weekend we had this past weekend. October is kind of sliding away from us, but it's here, and we can enjoy it. We've had beautiful fall weather here in central Iowa.
And even a few colored leaves.
It's just downright seasonal, isn't it? Yes, it is. This last weekend was Oktoberfest in downtown Ames, and I had the good opportunity to dance waltzes and polkas. Dancing on asphalt is not really my cup of tea, but the music was good, and it was fine. I enjoyed dancing to Barefoot Becky and the Ivanhoe Dutchman, yes. And later that evening, I went to the Central Iowa Barn Dance, and we danced to all kinds of things, including one of my favorite waltzes, Bodevalsen, a Scandinavian waltz that always reminds me of winter coming. It's one of those kind of minor key things that make you feel a little cold and dreamy. Anyway, waltzes and polkas.
I'm getting my firewood ready. I hope you have yours.
Oh, I've been stacking. Things are good. Everything's by the back door. We are ready for the wind to blow, sort of. Today on the Donalana Kitchen, we're going to talk about, waltzes and polkas and tarragon and garlic planting. And from the Donalana Kitchen archive, Donna talks about chestnuts with Luke Grant. And
it is chestnut season.
It is. Yes, chestnuts. Yes. And we'll take a look at some fine cookbooks that Donna brought in. This time of year, it's just so nice to go through those things and get some great ideas.
Yeah, I'm planning ahead, and I'll do this for Thanksgiving, and maybe that for Christmas. And some of these things need a long preparation, like if you were going to make mincemeat or things like that, it would be the time to start now.
Right, and now that you mention it, I always forget pfeffernusse need to be made early because pfeffernusse tastes better.
How early?
I'd say the 1st of December if you want them for Christmas. But if you want them for Thanksgiving, would they make a fine little Thanksgiving cookie, too? I'd start making them.
Lana is a very good cookie maker, I must say.
I love making cookies. So this year I may actually get on my baking horse, and make some pfeffernusse in time because they do taste better if they sit a while. So let's think about the holiday season. Let's think about all the good stuff that is coming up.
By the way, I went to a thing at Ryman Gardens on Sunday night. 500 pumpkins.
Oh, how fun.
500 is a lot of pumpkins.
Oh, good.
So it was a big, big project. They involved a lot of community volunteers carving all of these 500 pumpkins, and then they were kind of lit and spaced around the pond, and it was appropriately chilly, and we wandered around and saw 500 pumpkins carved. Amazing.
That sounds wonderful.
It was.
Did you carve?
No, I didn't. I was the audience, though.
My
neighbor Lou did some carving, so she knew all about it, and we all went over and all of a sudden, we felt very festive seasonally, You got to get in gear at some point. It's going to be Halloween, then it's going to be Thanksgiving, then it's going to be Christmas, and then it's going to be New Year's. And, oh, my.
Hold on to your hat.
There we go.
Very good. Also, it's time to harvest the last stuff. We've had a few frosts, but there's a few things you can grab out of the garden yet. And share the bounty if you have extra. I got a fine gift of tarragon from a friend. My tarragon plant died a while ago, so I was tarragon-less. So I got this nice bag of tarragon. Donna, tell me about tarragon.
Well, you know, we've been having tarragon discussions around the neighborhood. My good friend Gio, who's from Georgia, was saying, actually it's his wife Paula, who was telling me that the problem with making Georgian, really authentic Georgian food is that it requires huge amounts of tarragon.
And this is Georgia, as in
the country, between
the black and whatever sea that is.
Yeah, somewhere over there. And, yeah. You know, every time I see a picture of it, I want to go. But apparently Georgian food is just full of tarragon. So, of course, if you're buying, you know, two pieces of tarragon at the grocery store for $2.69 or whatever, you can't do this. So tarragon growing has been a question of late, and I asked my neighbor Ingrid Anderson, who seems to be good at growing tarragon, and here's what she said. She said she had terrible luck with it around here until she dug out a whole bunch of the place where she wanted to put the plant and mixed it half with sand and then half with the dirt and put it back in. And ever since, her tarragon has just been fabulous. And it is a perennial here.
There you go. That must be that darn good Iowa dirt. It's too much.
It's too much. Yep.
It's one of those tough love sort of things. Yep. I'm going to try that.
Yeah. Where do you get sand?
Oh, around a creek bank.
Oh, okay.
That's pretty easy.
Okay, all right.
Around a gravel pit or, you know.
Well, apparently that's the way to grow tarragon. So the most obvious familiar thing that people do with tarragon, like Lana just gave me this nice little bunch, and I am going to run home and put it in some probably rice wine vinegar and let it sit and sit and sit, because tarragon vinegar is quite good, and it's a wonderful way to preserve the tarragon, which, incidentally, though it will dry well, tarragon, like cilantro, dried, has about zero flavor. It very quickly loses its volatile oils. It's too delicate. So putting it in the vinegar. Another tasty thing, of course, is tarragon mustard. If you're into making your homemade mustard from scratch, you can put tarragon in that, and it's very, very good. And the sort of classic story I was telling Lana is tarragon and chicken are really good. Tarragon's really good in salads. I mean, it just has a million uses, and it's kind of not utilized much, especially in Midwestern cooking. But if you're in Paris and in certain neighborhoods with small grocery stores, out on the sidewalk, they do these mobile rotisserie cases, you know, the plug-in electrical things, and they put the chickens, and the chickens are turning and cooking in there and dripping and smelling, and they put it right on the sidewalk. So when you walk by, you just like,
oh, that is no fair.
Yeah, you just have to have it. So in the warmer months, often the chickens are stuffed with tarragon.
Stuffed, as in quite a bit.
Yeah, well, you know, you fill the internal cavity, and since it's rotating, it turns around, and as it cooks and the juices run from the inside out, the tarragon, like, just permeates the whole chicken and dribbles down. So in the warmer months, the smell is tarragon. In the cooler months, the smell is rosemary.
Oh, my.
They know what they're doing. That smell is just enticing.
So tarragon with your chickens. Mm-hmm. That sounds really good. Also, another thing that I've been doing in the garden and kind of ending up the season and looking forward again to the next season, it's time to plant garlic for all you garlic folks out there.
Yes, the Onion Creek Farm is the epicenter of garlic.
Well, it's just something I like to do. This is the time of year to plant at least the kind of varieties that I like, the hardneck garlics. There's all different kinds of garlic.
What are the names of some? They have such great names.
Oh, well, I grow one called Music.
Oh,
isn't that
right,
nice?
Right.
Isn't that? And then, but there's lots of other ones, too. And I have been growing one called Czech Red or Red Czech. I've seen it written both ways. But one nice thing about garlic is that once you get it growing, and if you save it back every year, you can plant your own seed garlic. You can plant your own out of what you've grown. That's kind of how the world works.
Now, you grow particularly large cloves, which I love.
Mm-hmm.
Good, strong, beautiful. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the beauty of the big clove is it's certainly less tedious for peeling. So about How do you plant them? You just separate the cloves, and each clove makes a new...
Each clove makes a new head. You plant them in the fall, along about Halloween here. I think it has something to do with the spirits in the air. But anyway, in a well-tilled bed, you know, or break up that dirt, take your clove of garlic. You don't need to take the paper off. And you push it down. I push it down just as far as my thumb will go.
You push it in point side down or root side down?
Root side down. Mm-hmm. The root side, roots go down. The pointy side goes up. Think about how it's going to grow. If mm-hmm. you happen to get it in crooked, you'll find next summer when you pull it up, the little garlic is kind of bent around itself. It knows where it wants to go. So roots down, pointy side up. And then,
the depth of your thumb.
I have a pretty small thumb, but it's going to get it deep, as deep as you can. And then after it sets a while, I hope for a little rain on top of it, at least, to kind of give it a little boost. And if it's warm enough, it will actually start putting out a few roots this time of year. But then it goes dormant over the winter, and it is ready to hop right at it in the spring because it's one of the first things that come up. And
mulch it. So you just stick it in, mm-hmm. and then you kind of pack it down. Mm-hmm. Oh, and then you mulch it.
I do mulch it. I do. That really, it keeps the weeds down. It kind of makes everything stay nicer when it starts to be the spring. It doesn't get so compacted.
And it doesn't freeze?
Oh, yeah, it freezes eventually. I mean, as the temperatures get colder and colder, it can freeze under that mulch. Yes, it can. But the garlic knows what it's doing. Garlic's been around for a long time.
Good.
Yeah, yeah. And it will. You'll see little green stuff coming up in the spring. Yeah, you will, I promise. And then it grows and grows and grows. And the kind of garlic that I plant is usually ready for harvest long about the 4th of July. So, plant it Halloween, harvest the 4th of July. Different species have a little different timing, but you can figure that out.
So, you were planting yesterday. How do you and Joe do it? Does he, like, till the row and
yeah,
then...
Yeah, we're fortunate enough to have a tiller on the back of a tractor, but we have used a hand tiller before. Mm-hmm. And I like things kind of neat and tidy. I have made a string spacer, two pieces of wood as wide as the bed, and I plant three rows in a bed, and I plant them about foot or 15, 18 inches apart. So there's three strings. I put a board on one side of the bed, walk down the bed a little while, pull that string straight. It's kind of like a builder's line that you're going to stretch, and I pull that tight, and there's three strings that's going to mark where I put the row, and so I plant three rows in a bed.
So you just kind of have a bunch of cloves separated mm-hmm.
yep,
in a bag or container. You just get down on the ground and start crawling along the row and sticking them in?
Yes, I do. I find my best way of doing it is wear a real old pair of jeans and slide down the row on my butt. Backwards. Mm-hmm. Whatever works for you.
And how many did you do?
Well, I've got a couple thousand in. A couple thousand heads. But that's because I make my living selling this stuff. So however many you want to do, if you're just doing
She makes her living. She also makes her fun doing this.
I make my fun doing this.
1,000 heads of garlic. That's more than 500 pumpkins.
It is.
Whoa, 1,000 heads.
This is the harvest.
And how did you do that all in one day?
No, no, I have two beds to go yet. I've got a few to go.
So, like, over 5 days? So,
yeah, yeah.
200
over
heads a day,
over
maybe?
Over a week, yeah. I just going to go out there a little bit at a time and with a bubble bath in between. So, enjoy the fall. Think of planting garlic. If you haven't done before, put some in your garden. Throw some leaves over it. Watch it grow. It's a fun thing to do.
Ah, it's really good to eat, too, when it happens.
Right. Well, Donna, you did a interview with a nice man called Luke Gran.
Oh, yes. A fine young fellow, Luke Gran, and his wife, Sally.
And we are going to run that interview. Luke Gran is a forester. Sometimes it's good to think in the long term. Trees take planning and care. Foresters take care of that. Luke has started a business called Prudentera, as in prudent, earth, Prudentera. And he helps people with trees and trees on a big scale.
And kind of rehabilitating your forest if you have one.
Right, right.
You know, what used to be called the woodlot. They may look chaotic, but they are best managed to produce wood, food for animals, and Luke has a way of putting all kinds of things in it that people want to eat.
Yes, here we go. Let's talk with Luke about chestnuts.
So foresters can help people manage, whether you're a homeowner, an acreage owner, or farmer, you've definitely got a value in considering bringing on an expert like a forester to help look at your cropland and find the low profitability parts of your farm and try to get those converted back to some of our native ecosystems to improve our water quality and our habitat for pollinators and other important species in our lives.
So what about the nut-bearing species? Specifically, we're going to talk about chestnuts today, of course, but what other nut-bearing species can we plant around here? Because that is an income crop.
That's right. Nuts are very, very interesting potential crop for people to think about. One of the most exciting possibilities out there is the Chinese chestnut. It's a crop you can plant once and then harvest for hundreds or even over 1,000 years.
Okay, now here's the nitty gritty story. When I think of chestnuts, okay, let's go back to Nat King Cole singing "Chestnuts Roasting on an Open Fire." Or then there's the poem that all children had to learn in grade school. "Under the blooming chestnut tree, the village smithy stands." You know, I mean, so this is an American iconic nut, and also eaten a lot in Europe. Tell us why we now have the Chinese chestnut.
Okay.
What's Chinese about it?
Yeah, well, I got to tell you, trees in America, and nut trees especially in America, were a big part of the reason why America was such a profitable place to have a colony and to settle. It was thought that for the first 100 years of agriculture in the new world, people had hogs that were fattened every year on
acorns, of course,
and
chestnuts.
Chestnuts.
So this is all basically early East Coast colonial farming.
Yeah. So throughout the eastern deciduous forest, which goes from Iowa all the way east to New England, and it's still there along the river valleys and all the way across the country. The most important species in that ecosystem was the American chestnut. It was the largest tree, the tallest tree, the largest diameter.
Yeah.
It produced an incredible amount of mast. Mast is a forester's term for nut production. So the seeds produced by trees is mast.
Mast. We like that word.
So the American chestnut was a huge part of why our ancestors were so successful in establishing
themselves. Because the pigs would actually just go out in the forest and feed themselves.
Absolutely. They'd gorge themselves on chestnuts in the fall.
And acorns.
Yep.
Wow.
Until about 1915 or so, there was an oriental, get this, there was an Asian pest, a disease, that came from, they called it oriental at the time, but it was a Chinese pest, a blight. Came mm-hmm. through, kind of like our emerald ash borer.
Yes.
And it annihilated, within 30 years, it annihilated every single American chestnut. The whole forest was just wiped out from this chestnut
blight. And
what
year was that?
1910 to 1940. Really recently, really. I mean, our grandparents.
Well, even I can remember, when my daughter was young, so that's 40 years ago, I lived in a rural area and we had a gorgeous chestnut mm-hmm. tree. So let's see. That would have been 1970s.
Very possible. There was probably some new chestnuts planted, potentially even some Chinese chestnuts. So the whole reason why we went with Chinese chestnuts is because they were naturally resistant to this blight.
So now I noticed in the last 10 years, more and more we're starting to see domestic chestnuts again, especially even here in Iowa, local chestnuts. So when would these trees have been planted?
You know, it takes about 7 to 10 years to get some commercial production. So I would say that if these folks started in the mid-90s or late-90s, that'd mm-hmm. be early enough, recent enough to have a crop.
And how tall is a chestnut tree after 7 years?
Well, the height of a tree is really dependent on the quality of the site and how densely...
How much sun it gets, you mean?
Well, the quality of the site is kind of talking about the kind of soils, like how high quality, how fertile the soils are, and how well-suited are they to grow the trees.
And what are chestnuts like in
chestnuts
soil?
Chestnuts like well-drained soils that are slightly acidic. If you've got a well-drained soil, you know, something doesn't get too waterlogged in the spring or at all, chestnuts will be happy. And if it's not low enough pH, 5.5 to 6.5 is their favorite range.
And what makes soils like that around here have that
clarion?
PH?
Clarion would be a typical.
Okay, clarion is.
Well, if I was talking to farmers, they'd probably know some of these names. But
I know, but this is, we're at the kitchen table here. So you're here to educate me and all of those who are listening with us. So
yeah.
What's clarion?
Yeah, so soil types that are well-drained are loamy, which a loam soil means it's got equal parts sand, silt, and clay.
So it's kind of loose then.
Yeah, it's a loose soil.
Uh-huh.
It feels like if you picked it up in your hand, it would feel nice and soft and not too... heavy and thick, you know, it'd be fairly.
What makes other than pine trees make?
Well, they'd like to have not in the valleys, you know, because you can get frost pockets. That's dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, just with any orchard, you don't want to put them in the low spots because they'll get zapped by a spring frost. You know, when they've started to flower.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Oh, so a chestnut is like an apple tree. If the flowers get zapped, you don't have nuts.
It's not as sensitive as apple trees are. Apple trees and chestnut trees are miles apart in their complexity and challenge to grow in Iowa.
We are back. That was a little tune called The Prune Song. Oh, yes, it was. We like food songs here. You're listening to KHOI 89.1. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. This is Tasty Radio for the Heart of Iowa. Let's go back to Donna's interview with Luke Grand talking about chestnuts.
Well, when do they bloom?
My favorite reference for Chinese chestnuts in Iowa is the Chestnut Growers Primer, written and illustrated by Tom Wall.
Okay.
So Tom Wall's a wonderful farmer from southeast Iowa in Lawaiza.
So Tom is growing a lot of chestnuts then, I guess, huh?
I think he's got 5 or so acres planted now.
Wow.
Chinese chestnuts. Yeah.
Now, how would one market 5 acres of chestnuts?
The market is tremendous for chestnuts. If you've got the supply, there's people all over the country that will send a truck. A semi-truck. I think it really depends on just like with every crop, it depends on the year, you know, how much the yield is. And
well, what about a year like this where we've had a lot of rain,
excellent.
Not too hot, not too cold?
Chinese chestnuts definitely need rain in August. That's when they're filling their nuts.
We did it.
So that was excellent. So I'm sure it's been a bumper crop year for
Chinese
chestnuts.
Oh, good. Chestnut so we can growers. Say this year is a good chestnut year.
That's right.
Okay, now what determines the size of the chestnut?
The variety of the genetics plays a huge role.
Oh, there's different kinds of Chinese chestnut trees.
Yeah, just like cultivars or varieties are different for different.
So why would you plant the one with small nuts? Everybody wants the big nuts.
Actually, there are markets where it's actually a very diverse marketplace. So you've got some buyers that only want medium-sized nuts, and you've got some buyers that only want extra-large nut-sized nuts.
Well, what are people doing with them besides the culinary things? Obviously, you can make flour out of it, which is wonderful for baking. You can certainly – recipes, they're just great for roasting and eating. So what else – are they used for pig food? That would seem very luxurious.
Yeah, if you've got a low quality chestnut, like something that's been, if you've got, like, for example, stuff that's got weevils in it or something, ideal for feed for livestock.
Now, so the pigs eat the shell and everything?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They'll just gobble it up.
Okay.
So excited about it.
And they do the same thing with acorns? They eat the whole shell and everything?
Yeah.
Oh, boy. And that's how you get the best pork. So good for those little guys. So how are we doing in Iowa in terms of planting chestnuts?
It's a fine place for growing Chinese chestnuts. Yeah. If you're in the southeast half of the state, definitely. You've got ideal soil types and climate to grow several different varieties.
Oh, so is it difficult the colder you get?
Yeah, if you get up to northwest Iowa, it's not advised at this time to plant Chinese chestnuts. You'd have to plant American chestnut hybrids, because American chestnuts can grow way up in Canada.
Oh, okay.
But Chinese chestnuts are
so
more...
we now have new American chestnut hybrids
yes.
that can withstand the pest from China.
They think there's hybrids that they've been hybridizing Chinese chestnuts with American chestnuts. There's some promising hybrids that have tried to breed into the American chestnut, the Chinese chestnut resistance.
Well, great. Mm-hmm. So what kind of market? For example, Tom Wall, who's growing his 5 acres of chestnuts?
They are, yeah.
And what do you suppose he does with them?
Well, I was just down there last fall. I visited Tom at his place maybe 5 or 6 times over the last 5 years, and trees in a
now,
row.
Are they planted in rows like orchards?
Yeah. Yeah,
huh.
Very similar, just to facilitate mowing, to facilitate management.
Oh, okay.
Mowing is really important for Chinese chestnut production because all the nuts fall off onto the ground.
Oh, so you're going to be able to find them.
You've got to pick them up off the ground.
How do you harvest them? By hand?
Yeah, you use this little thing called a nut wizard. It's a little basket with a stick, and so you like roll this basket on the ground.
Oh, I've seen those. It's sort of a large wire egg shape.
Yep.
But now chestnuts don't they have that prickly kind of furry cover?
Yeah, no, that's only on the tree.
So the nut doesn't fall until it opens out of the burry thing, and then you just roll the little nut
yep.
grabber over it?
Yep.
And...
So the burrs protect the nuts while they're ripening on the tree,
uh-huh.
and then the burrs open up and the nuts fall to the ground.
How does, like, the tree disgorge everything at once, or you have to keep running the little nut grabber around for a period of a few weeks, or how do you harvest
every
them?
Day, you got to pick them up off the ground for a harvest season that could last between 2 and 8 weeks long.
So if you have 5 acres, is there a mechanical nut picker-upper?
There are several designs that have been tried, like in California, where they have like bare dirt understories where they
uh-huh.
don't have. So really the best way, most efficient way to pick up the nuts is by hand. And Tom Wall actually has a list of like 80 people who will drive 3 hours one way for the privilege to pay him to pick up Chinese chestnuts. Immigrants from Bosnia actually come from Waterloo every year.
Oh, you're kidding.
They just love it. It's Eastern Bosnia, I think, has just a really strong cultural tradition of Chinese chestnuts.
Oh, goody. Then do you have any idea what kind of recipes they're making with those chestnuts?
Almost all of them are just eating them fresh. They go to a park and they make a big fire and they roast nuts and talk and gab and have a great time and eat roasted chestnuts fresh.
Now, do you know anything about nutritionally what chestnuts do?
Oh, they're phenomenal. They're a starchy nut. They're kind of like the corn of nuts. So they're literally have been referred to as the corn of nuts. So they're very high in starch. They are very low in fat.
Yes, I was going to say they're much lower in fat than most nuts. But they're still a nut. So how's the protein in them?
Pretty good. Pretty good source of protein, low amount of fat, but not a super protein rich nut like others. So it's really you got to think of it as like a, you know, it's commonly used as stuffing in poultry. So it's kind of it's got a starchy component. You should really
Yeah.
It's a kind of like a fun, like popcorn's starch, and so.
Do you encourage people who are like, for example, if somebody has like a a part of a farm that was, we used to call it the woodlot, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, obviously, you have to manage it in some ways. Could one put chestnuts in something like that?
Chestnuts, you know, you're going to probably want to put a chestnut in, you know, wherever you have the best, highest quality soil, the well-drained and slightly acidic soil. And in a woodlot, you know, you're going to probably need at least 100 feet by 100 feet of open space so you can get enough sunlight to.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because it's not a shade tolerant tree.
And is the same thing true if you want to put acorns in? Apparently we're losing our oaks too because we have so much scrub that the little guys are not getting the sun they need.
Yeah, oaks are a shade intolerant species, so they only regenerate when they have full sun. So oaks evolved to regenerate in the open sun after a prairie fire, and they creeped into the prairie from the woodland edge, and that's why we have so many oaks in Iowa, because we have a really long history of fire in our ecosystems.
But, yes, which we don't do much anymore.
Yeah, we need to do more fire on the landscape. We need to have more fire on the landscape for sure. So, yeah, so if I was going to plant a Chinese chestnut on a farm, I would I'd find the best soil types to suit that species and give it a lot of full sun for rigorous growth. Although I just said that on my own little farmstead, we just put in a row of Chinese chestnuts and pawpaws.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, that's right.
And pawpaws. You can do
that's
them
right.
together?
That's right. So pawpaw is an understory tree.
Oh.
So it'll tolerate the shade of the chestnut. And so we did 20 by 20 spacing for the Chinese chestnuts.
Okay. So you put a chestnut tree and then you space 20 feet.
Yep, 20 feet apart from other trees, 20 feet apart from the next chestnut.
Okay.
And then we stuck in a pawpaw 10 feet between the two.
And how big does a pawpaw get?
Oh, they'll get to be about 20, 25 feet probably max. So fairly small understory tree.
Okay. How long now? How big were the chestnuts when you planted them? Did you start with
I started with seed. So I started with seed from Tom Wall, and then I put it in grew it out in a tree pot.
Mm-hmm.
Typical, like a seedling tree growing, tree production pot, like a container pot. And then I waited till the tree was about 3 feet tall and stuck
it. How long did it take to get to be 3 feet tall?
Well, I think I started growing it in the spring, and by August it was 2 or 3 feet tall.
Oh, it grew that much in 1 year?
Yep.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's really fun to grow your own trees.
3 feet. Okay, so you put a 3-foot chestnut seedling out, mm-hmm. and then how big was the pawpaw?
Pawpaw was about half that size. They are really slow growing.
Oh, good. So the chestnut will just keep shooting up above the pawpaw.
Yep.
Now, where would you stick the persimmon trees in that mix?
Ooh, I love persimmons. I stuck them in a more open spot to the, probably separate from the chestnut growth.
Did you actually put some in?
I put two persimmons in last fall.
So. Oh, so... harvesting chestnuts, then they just like fall from the sky and you pick them up and they're ready for roasting, right? As soon as they fall out of the tree.
Well, you want to cure them first.
Oh, curing. You have to cure them.
Yeah, curing is the best.
How do you cure them?
Curing is very simple. It's just you have to just wait a few certain number of days.
What, are they just too wet when they first fall?
Yeah, they're just, like every nut, they improve their flavor after you cure them. So... just every species has different curing.
Well, is curing basically drying?
Yeah, at a certain humidity and temperature range that they prefer.
So, for example, if you went down to Tom Wall's and you picked 2 bushels of chestnuts up off the ground, then what would you do?
So you got to
spread them out on the dining room table.
Well, make sure that they're separated from any leaves, twigs, or burrs, or mm-hmm. rocks, or anything. Make sure there's no dirt on them. Clean them off mm-hmm. if you got a little dirt on them. And then they should be sealed in a Ziploc bag, and just somewhere where they can get a high humidity.
Humidity.
Yeah.
So you're not drying them.
Yep. And then keep them cool.
And, like how cool?
Oh, probably between 28 and 30 degrees Fahrenheit. That's for storage temperature. So fairly cool.
So below freezing.
Yeah, just that's how they can maintain the longest shelf life. You keep them really cold.
So you would put them in the freezer? Or that's too cold?
That's too cold, yeah. It's high humidity, but very cool. Hmm. So 80 to 90% humidity is the preferred.
Yeah, well, my best advice is... eat them before they rot. I mean, usually I do eat them in the fall. That's the normal, up to winter. And they will start to rot if you're not careful.
Yeah, it's really important that they stay.
And they also can get so dry that even when you roast them, they're just completely...
Yeah, and you, but you can always like grind them up and use them as flour if they get too dry.
Yeah, but so. You still have to get that outer shell off of them.
You know the secret to that is just make a little X, like take a sharp chef's knife, make a little X in it, and stick it in the microwave for like 6 minutes.
Microwave?
I don't know.
You can stick them in the oven too, folks.
Yeah, that's true.
Because I don't have a microwave. But and the trees will live how long?
There are Chinese chestnuts in China that are at least 1,300 years old.
Wow. So they last even longer than oaks?
Yeah, they could if they're managed and you know, it's...
Talk about an investment for the future. The seven generations would be really happy if you planted them now.
That's right.
So Luke has a little sticker from his business called Prudent Terra. It says, "My farm invests in ecosystems." You want to explain that sticker?
Well, I just feel like farmers and landowners who take care of their land with prairie, and maybe they manage their woodlands, and maybe they plant some trees or plant a Chinese chestnut orchard. They have to make an investment to make those things successful. Prairie takes about 3 years to get started, and trees can take 5 years to get started, and Chinese chestnut grove might take 7 or 10 years until you can start commercially harvesting from it.
Oh, they must be beautiful.
They are gorgeous, yeah. And so I feel like a big part of my job is just to show people all the fun ways that, I mean, on farms, people are spending money all the time. You know, they're investing in...
It's a business.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Investing in this year for this year's crop, you know, with this spray or this chemical or... So essentially, all my recommendations or all my opportunities that I share with my clients are investments that take years to be. I was in a family meeting with a client, and I pitched several different proposals to them. You know, blew me away. The oldest guy in the room was the most excited about the 15-year return on the Chinese chestnuts.
Yeah, because he knows how quickly 15 years goes, you know.
He was 80-something years old, and he was excited about getting cheap trees in the ground. There's something about legacy that's really important. And...
Let's take a little of that corn and soy cropland and just stick in some
chestnuts. It's time.
Okay, well, Luke is working on this for us, and I expect in about 10 years we're all going to be out at Luke's harvesting,
I'm going to need all your help, and I'll have nut wizards for everyone.
You're listening to KHOI. This is Community Radio for the Heart of Iowa, and this is the Dinah Luna Kitchen. Let's take a little break now with a waltz. Go ahead. Find a partner. Pick up your cat. Dance around the kitchen table. This is the Blue Skirt Waltz. We're back. That was a blue skirt waltz. That always reminds me of my dad. He did like a good waltz. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen, and today Donna's going to talk about eating chestnuts. It's the season.
Well, I have a book that I checked out of the Ames Library. It's called Flavor Flowers. Subtitle, A New Way to Bake with Teff, Buckwheat, Sorghum, and Other Whole and Ancient Grains, Nuts, and Non-Wheat Flours. The author is Alice Medrich, who is a well-known, I believe she's a James Beard Award-winning author. She's a very well-known cookbook writer for desserts. And she has a whole chapter on chestnut flour. She talks about some of the stuff that Luke and I just talked about. She does say chestnuts are 78% carbohydrates and only 1% fat. This, I think, is why it's a really good flour. She does say where to buy and how to store. Chestnut flour is available in some better supermarkets and specialty stores. Not around here, probably. And otherwise, it's available by mail order. And she does give us a spot for mail order. Let's see if I can find it really quickly. Because I'm going to order some. It's called Allen Creek Farm. And you can find that at www.chestnutsonline.com. That's pretty easy to do. chestnutsonline.com. So I'm going to actually order myself some Allen Creek chestnut flour. And she says, if you're not going to use it in 2 to 3 months, keep the chestnut flour in an airtight container in the refrigerator or freezers. And then she has a bunch of recipes, simple things like a chestnut, what kind of cake was that? A chestnut and honey tart. Oh, here's the one I think I might be trying. Chocolate chestnut souffle cake. So it's basically a flourless chocolate cake made with some chestnut flour. And then in the picture, she's got pine nuts on it. It looks fabulous. The other one is she has a sponge cake recipe, which really, really looks good. And then she pairs it with one with figs and one with praline whipped cream and da-da-da-da-da. And then there is a chestnut pudding, chestnut praline gelato. I actually was thinking I've had chestnut gelato in Italy, and probably a recipe that I might try myself is to take a vanilla ice cream base, and then you can buy this French preparation, which is it's called crème de marron, which means cream of chestnut, and it's a kind of sugary, chestnutty flavored paste. Not too thick. It's kind of, you can actually buy it in tubes and squeeze the stuff right out. So you could, if you made an ice cream base of vanilla and took a tube of that and squeezed it right into the ice cream maker, you'd probably have a pretty good gelato. I'm thinking of trying that. I'll let you know how it is.
And this chestnut flour does have the taste of chestnut.
Oh, yeah.
Oh yeah. Wonderful.
It does. It's really yummy for baking. Here's the one I think I might try for Thanksgiving.
Here we are thinking ahead. Yep. There's some feasts coming up.
We're planning ahead. Well, I'm going to go visit my son in Vermont, and I think we'll be having Thanksgiving dinner with some friends of his and their parents and stuff like that. So maybe I'll be taking desserts or something. I don't really know. So I was thinking that this one, it's a chestnut and walnut meringue. Now, my son Arian loves meringue, so I thought this would be really good. So it's your kind of standard meringue recipe into which you dump a 1/4 cup of chestnut flour and 3/4 cups of chopped walnut pieces and 3/4 cups of sugar, and that's it. You know, you whip the egg whites this is for 3 egg whites at room temperature and 1/4 teaspoon of cream of tartar. So basically you're whipping the egg whites and then slowly incorporating the sugar, and then at the very, probably the sugar, the chestnut flour, and then at the very end the walnut pieces, and then you have to cook them at a low oven, like 300 for, you know, until they're not mushy, basically.
Yeah, I could use some help with some meringue. The idea is to whip the egg whites, so they're rather stiffish.
Stiff and dry, yeah.
So they make those little Dairy Queen cups.
Yeah, and then you can either I use a Silplat liner so they don't stick, but you can also use parchment paper and things like that. And the idea is you can either pipe them on if you want a special shape, or you can just dollop it on, not too close. They don't run much, but you need a little space between them. And the trick, especially here in the Midwest where it's so humid, because the humidity can make it difficult.
It is tricky, yes.
Right. When you're reading a recipe, usually you will have to bake them a little bit longer than it says. And don't try to make them on a rainy day. It's just too difficult.
Yes.
So you kind of have to wait till the weather is – like we've had a good dry spell. So right now, although it was supposed to rain last night, but I don't think it did.
Maybe tonight. Yeah, that's true. I have had mushy meringues, and it was a rainy day. And I remember my mom trying things, and, well, on a rainy day it didn't work, so she'd just give us a spoon. There was our dessert.
Oh, yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
Oh, but chestnut – meringues. Now that sounds
I know.
Really,
doesn't that
really
sound good?
Good?
And so in her book, Alice Medrich says, flavor affinities for chestnut flour. Are you ready? This is quite a nice list. Honey, especially chestnut honey, hazelnuts, walnuts, pine nuts, dark or white chocolate, brandy or cognac, Grand Marnier, sweet fortified wines such as sherry or Marsala, caramel, cardamom, fresh cheese such as ricotta, mascarpone cheese, creme fraiche, then cinnamon, coffee, figs, ginger, maple, prunes and plums, pears, apples, orange zest, and brown sugar. Now, does that sound like a fall lineup?
It does. It does. Those tastes sound like it'd be a good thing for, not all of them, I don't think all of them, but some of those picked out of there, oh, like the maple taste, or a brown sugar taste, or a good cognac would be nice for the roasted chestnuts.
Well, she says that the chestnut flour can come roasted or unroasted, mm-hmm. and they're interchangeable. Mm-hmm. She prefers the raw flour, but she does say be careful that it's not too smoky if you're using it from a cooked – how you know, depend on how the processor is doing, because some people will – toast their chestnuts on an open flame to cook them and then grind them from there, and you can get it too smoky. I have seen home-crafted flours like that where it's a little too strong in the smoky. But you can – she says if you pair it with rice flour, it makes a flavorful shortbread crust for tarts. And she's got cookie recipes and, just think about where – I'm thinking – actually, tomorrow I have to make apple crisp for 100, and I have a bag of chestnut flour, and I have a quarter of these ladies are gluten-free.
There you go.
So I was thinking, I could mix it with oats and maybe some
– rice flour?
Rice flour and maybe even a little ground almond flour. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That would probably make an excellent topping for an apple crisp.
So give the name of the book.
Okay,
and the
one more time.
Again.
This is Flavor Flours, A New Bay to Bake with Teff, Buckwheat, Sorghum, and Other Whole and Ancient Grains, and Nut Flours. It's Alice Medrich. It is available at the public library. However, I have the copy right now. So she's a good source for working with chestnut flours.
Yay! Oh, it sounds like fall. You also brought in another book that you'd like to mention.
Oh well, this is I'm working on another event that's not going to happen till next spring, but it's the 20th year that my co-chef. It's for Organic Farming Research Foundation, and we do it at the Natural Products Show in Anaheim, where we bring in every single organic ingredient for the meal is organic. And so since it's our 20th anniversary, and my co-chef, Chris Blobaum, is also an Iowa farm boy, we thought we're going to feature Midwestern food. So just to get my brain started while I'm writing the menu, I'm looking at a copy of something called The New Midwestern Table by Amy Thielen, T-H-I-E-L-E-N, 200 recipes from the heartland. Now, she is she's basically a northern Minnesotan, so there's a lot of northern, you know, whitefish kind of things. But a lot of it's very – what I like about this book, she also cooked with some very major East Coast chefs in – like in New York. So she's quite an accomplished chef. She's also a good storyteller. And so she talks about, you know, where it came from, who made it in her family, how it's eaten, and it has all kinds of really interesting things. One of the things, I think we talked about this. She has the first recipe that I made from here was with herring. You know, we love pickled herring. So actually, I just buy it at the grocery store. And then I drain off all the vinegar because it's a little bit sour for me, some of that. And then I put it in sour cream. And her recipe also includes horseradish. Gee, I should have looked it up. I'm trying to think. It was so – apple, I think, grated apple, horseradish.
Yes, I remember there was a little bit of sweet. And I do like herring. I do like herring.
And, of course, fresh onions. All right, I'm not finding it. Let me just tell you the book again. It's called The New Midwestern Table by Amy Thielen. We'll probably drag out a few more recipes from this book because we're going to start in on holiday dishes, and there's a lot of stuff in here like butter-basted walleye. That's very northern. And then she's got, Swedish recipes. Oh, herring with cooked in liquorice prosciutto. That's an Iowa dish. So she has a lot of Swedish and Czech dishes and like the best ever beer cheese soup.
Oh, there we go.
Homegrown celery soup with crab meat. I don't know where she's getting the crab, but a whole chapter on wild rice and this sounds good. Rhubarb tarragon sangria.
There we go with the tarragon. Oh, yes, rhubarb tarragon.
Yeah. So here it is. I'll just give you this one quick. So it's a quarter cup of sugar, 2 cups thickly sliced fresh rhubarb, 5 sprigs of fresh tarragon, 1 bottle of white wine, 1 bottle of rosé, and the juice of a lime. So you combine the water, sugar, and the rhubarb in a saucepan, bring to boil, cook, standing by until the rhubarb is just starting to get tender. 30 seconds to 1 minute. So really, really fast. Remove from the heat and let steep until cool. Pour the rhubarb and its syrup into a large pitcher. So all the chunks and everything, I guess. Add the tarragon. Chill until very cold. And then you add the white wine, the rosé, and the lime juice. And you pour the sangria over ice cubes. How easy could that be?
Sangria with rhubarb sounds really tasty. So stay tuned to the Donalana Kitchen for more good recipes. We get together here every Tuesday at noon. We're repeated Tuesday at 7 p.m. You can find us live streaming and all that stuff at khoifm.org. We heard the music before of Barefoot Becky and the Ivanhoe Dutchman. We'll go out with another one of their tunes in the spirit of Halloween. We'll go out with Polka. This one's called Apples, Peaches, Pumpkin Pie. It sort of refers to a game of hide-and-seek, I believe.
It's a poem.
It is.
And then we're over there, over here, over there, we're everywhere. Let's all play hide-and-seek.
So thank you for joining us. My name is Lana Noctico.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
This is the Donna Lana Kitchen, engineering by Evan Taylor. Eat good food and enjoy life.
Who's that ready? Holler, let's all play hide.